Welcome to episode 13 of FemLonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we're going to talk about political platforms. With elections currently happening in PEI and Alberta, and with the federal election and the Newfoundland and Labrador election around the corner, we think the timing is perfect. I'll be joined by Joan Kingston, a former New Brunswick cabinet minister, among many other qualifications, to discuss how platforms are made and what the importance they hold in our current political landscape is. Next, we're going to join the current election campaigns in Alberta and PEI and do a high-level analysis on the party platforms from a gender and inclusion lens. In our interview with Joan, you'll hear her talk about the importance of time and place in construction of platforms. As a disclaimer, I am a New Brunswicker who has been in Ottawa for the past 6 weeks. I won't purport to having a full understanding of time and space in the Alberta and PEI context. I've looked at the platforms based on content, but recognize that I'm not an expert in Alberta or PEI politics. I hope you'll still find some value in this episode. Okay, let's chat with Joan. Joan, thank you so much for joining FemLonk today. I'm really excited about our conversation. To get us started, I'd actually ask if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself.
Well, thank you, Katie. My name is Joan Kingston, and I am a former politician, a former aide to politicians, a former member of cabinet, and a present advocate, I guess. So I've been involved in politics for a long time, first prior to the 1995 election, where I was elected as the MLA for New Maryland, and subsequently served in the government of Frank McKenna and the Liberals. And was appointed to cabinet there. Following that, I served under Camille Theriault, Ray Frenette, and then went into the private sector, or really public sector, for a little while. Came back into the opposition office, followed Sean Graham into the premier's office. Anyway, served there as principal secretary, and then went back into private life, and then working for the University of New Brunswick, which is what I do now.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I really look forward to chatting about some of those different roles and how, with our topic today, platform development, how you kind of interacted with that through some of those different roles. Later on in the episode, we're going to analyze the platforms of the Alberta parties and the PEI parties as they go into their elections. And we'll also probably do that with the federal election up and coming. So I really wanted to give our listeners a high level overview of like what the heck a platform is, what its kind of purpose is, and how it's developed. So in that lens, I'd love your input on just the basic question of what a platform is.
Okay, well, a platform is a statement by the party, and particularly by the leader of the party of the day, as to where they would like to take the province if they gain the confidence of the people. So it really is for the leader and for the politicians of the day, it's really an exercise in looking at your grassroots, your base in a party system, and seeing what it is that is important to them, what their values are, what they believe in, how they see society unfolding, and then to reflect that in the platform. Generally speaking, it is vetted on several levels over time, generally over at least a couple of years, with grassroots party members talking about what it is that their sort of concerns or their focuses are of the day, the things that they think are needed to bring society forward, and then developing a bunch of planks, actually, some actual sort of on the ground type of practical ways of honoring those values and of doing things that would actually move society forward, given the other things that are going on in the world, in your world, such as federal politics, you know, sort of local issues, all those kinds of things. So in my mind, that's what a platform is. It's sort of a statement about how you want to express your values in a particular election in order to convince, I guess, the electorate that you are going to be doing things that they would support, that would make them comfortable, that they would feel would move them forward as a group, as a society.
Yeah, so I heard you say or talk about the importance of the leader's perspective, of the party member's perspective, and then about winning over the electorate in the platform. So I'd love your input on some of the key ways that the platform really comes together. Like, how do all of those ideas get discussed and pulled together into, you know, a 30-page document, for example?
At the time, because an election always takes place in a moment in time, you sort of have to kind of feel the pulse of the electorate to see what is important to the people who are thinking in your direction, you know, pulling in your direction. So you hopefully, and you must actually, have been talking all along to the people at the base of your party, the people who are supporting you, who believe in the values of the party that you represent. You also, of course, are listening to the leaders of those various groups. So in a province like New Brunswick, you would have 2.5 dozen, 3 dozen MLAs that would be telling you what they're hearing on the ground, what's important in their community, what they've heard not only from the grassroots, but from other interest groups and business groups in their area. So you sort of put all of that into the mix, along with what seems to be the most pressing issues that the total electorate is feeling at this point, and what would your response be to those concerns of the electorate?
I'd love your opinion on if the role of the platform, I guess, has changed over time from your perspective, like from perhaps the first election you ran into. Even today, we see some parties across the country put forward platforms that are vague, not costed out, or the opposite end and are incredibly detailed and, you know, 100 pages long. So I'd love your perspective on if platforms overall have changed in the importance they have to elections, and just, yeah, what that shift over time has maybe looked like.
Well, I think when I look at it as an advocate, and I have been an advocate in some ways from the very beginning, because I came to politics as a nurse who wanted to, you know, affect healthy public policy and so on. And that was sort of my beginning sort of thoughts in terms of how I could make a difference. Today, I feel somewhat the same way, in that there are certain aspects of any platform that would be more near and dear to my heart, although over the years I've developed a more global attitude toward the platform in general. But I think the one thing that the platform has to express and has to give to people, has to have people believe, is that the values of the party are expressed in the platform. Really, in an election, for instance, the electorate is looking at who would best represent me in terms of leading the province or the country forward. So when they look at any platform, or more likely pieces of the platform, so me as a nurse, I tend to look at pieces of the platform that deal with health, that maybe deal with early childhood education, for instance, because that's an important kind of social determinant of health, things that are dealing with social development, poverty reduction, things like that. Those are the things that I look for in the platform. Other people may look at the platform from another point of view, but generally speaking, everybody puts their values first and then looks at the platforms in terms of, are the policies that this party is putting forward, do they make sense? Do they reflect what I think that this party means in terms of the values that I hold.
Yeah, and so from that perspective, a big piece of the platform then is also how it's communicated and how, I guess, it's presented to voters. Because again, some platforms, again, just doing the starting the work on the analysis, the United Conservative Party platform in Alberta, it is literally 100 pages long. It has a lot of stuff in there. And so as a voter, trying to consume that would be very difficult. But if you knew the key things you were looking out for, it might be a bit easier, I guess. But yeah, I guess my question is, it's a bit convoluted here. I apologize. I'm thinking as I'm speaking. But what role does that communication play in giving that message over to voters or giving that information to voters?
Well, if you talk about the platform that you've just described, to me, that is not a communication piece at all. That is just something to park somewhere and say, oh, yes, we've addressed this, we've addressed that, we've addressed the next thing. But I can't imagine that in their quest to be chosen by the people, that they aren't emphasizing certain areas of their platform, or maybe they're not. Maybe they're going completely on sort of, do you trust this approach or do you trust that approach?
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because again, I think back to the point you mentioned about particular people are looking for particular things, particularly in, you know, the advocacy community, but, you know, me as well, if I'm looking at a platform or if I'm looking to choose a party, there are a handful of things that are really key to me and non-negotiable. Yeah, I wonder what role the communication plays in that overarching theme. And I think, to your point, the values piece is so important. But it has seemed to me in the last few elections I've seen just in different provinces over the last few years that maybe the policy is getting lost. So I wonder your opinion on what roles platforms play in modern campaigns. And is it maybe is the value statement more important or becoming more important than that detailed list of what the party is going to accomplish?
If I could, and this is something that you can take or not take, but I would just like to talk about something that Andy Scott, person who I was a mentor of mine when I was younger, told me one time. And he said that only about 30% of the electorate actually vote based on a relatively detailed look, even at their own sort of set of important issues. And so there are 30% of the population that sort of look at everything, look at all the parties, see what it is that they're saying in detail, and really intentionally place their vote that way. The other 70% in his mind, and this was years ago, so I'm going back some, but he said that the other 70% vote on an emotional response to what they hear the party saying. So do the parties speak to them? Do the candidates speak to them? Does the leader of the party speak to them? Does that message connect with them? That is how they vote. And so I would say that maybe not too much has changed over time. I think people have access to so much information at this point in time that they certainly have more opportunity than any generation in the past to access information if they wish. Do more than 30% do that at this point, to Andy's point? I'm not sure. I certainly have had no one of any gravitas tell me anything about that since. But it's still an interesting thought in my mind always as to what motivates people to vote in a particular way, to support in a particular way, to engage in a particular way. I'll leave it at that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think I sometimes get very much caught up as one of those 30% folks. I love platforms, love, you know, working on them, love reading them, but I also recognize probably couldn't even count 30% of the folks you maybe talk to at the doors that would even reference the platform. So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind when we're having this broader conversation about what a platform is and how it, what role it plays in elections overall.
I think it's necessary. A platform is necessary for the party and for the people that are representing that party to have something to stand on, to know what it is that they are promoting, to know what it is that they believe in, that they believe will move society forward over the next 4 years. I think that's absolutely necessary. How much of that is digested by the public in any kind of depth, I'm not certain.
Yeah, no, that I've never thought about it that way, but I think that makes a lot of sense. You've given me lots to think about, Joan.
Well, that's good. I'm glad.
Yes, absolutely. No, I'm excited to bring some of these lenses to the platform analysis that we do. I'm going to try to be a bit concise so I don't bore too many people. But yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating, and I'm excited to keep looking at how the platforms for, because I think there's of course the federal election coming up, and I think Newfoundland and Labrador will be going to the polls soon as well. So yeah, I'm going to keep thinking about what this looks like. Any final thoughts?
I just think good for you. Good for you, keeping track of all of this, because really you see the wave of public opinion one following another, and obviously in some kind of way, even though it might not be specific to specific party platforms, certainly how people are feeling transmits, I think, from one jurisdiction to another. And so I think it's really important for us to keep track of what's going on around us so that we understand what kinds of things that people are concerned about. And of course, in these days of really easy information transfer, I think that it's even more necessary to sort of be able to put our own province in its own context. Every jurisdiction is somewhat different. I think that we have to remember that solutions are local, politics is local, and that we need to keep that in mind when we're developing platforms and when we're presenting ourselves to the electorate for consideration.
Thank you so much for chatting with us today, Joan.
Well, thank you very much, Katie. It was nice to chat with you.
Okay, so we're going to start with Alberta. We don't want this episode to be hours long, so we've decided to just analyze the top two contenders for forming government in both Alberta and PEI. We're going to start with Alberta, and when this episode airs, it will be election day in Alberta. So if you live in Alberta and it's April 16, stop listening and go vote, or listen to the Alberta section on your way to the polls. After our interview with Joan, I've been thinking about platforms a bit differently. So I'm not going to analyze every single platform commitment, but rather highlight a few key things that I noted. I'm also going to provide high-level takes on the platforms as a whole. Okay, so the Alberta NDP have 53% women running for them, and they're led by Rachel Notley. In my opinion, the biggest bright spot in the NDP platform is their childcare policy, the Alberta Affordable Childcare Program. We talk about the pillars of an effective childcare program in episode 6 of FemLonk. I will make sure to link it in the show notes. By and large, the NDP platform commits to a $25 a day childcare program, the creation of 13,000 new spots, higher quality childcare enhanced through staff training, and an online portal for communities to be able to make their informed decisions. So as you can see, the program they've outlined seems to consider affordability, accessibility, and high quality care. It's no surprise that this is a key pillar of the NDP platform, but it is a costly one, so I think that they had to make some decisions, of course, on what they could and couldn't include based on that. The platform also commits to expanding reproductive health care and by stating that they would expand access for women living in smaller centers and rural Alberta. Those are really the only two specifically women-facing commitments. However, they commit to a number of things that would benefit both women and underrepresented folks, including piloting two storefront mental health clinics in Edmonton and Calgary to provide immediate access to mental health care and people experiencing a mental health crisis. By building and modernizing 70 new schools, developing online health tools, eliminating tuition fees for high school, upgrading and English language learning programs, ensuring Alberta's employment and labor laws are modern and up to date for both employers and workers in all sectors, reviewing and modernizing the community grants for nonprofit organizations. And they also have three distinct sections in their platform entitled An Inclusive and Diverse Alberta, which focuses on multiculturalism, protecting LGBTQ Albertans, and reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. I think the NDP likely made a conscious decision not to include many specifically gendered commitments for a few reasons. One, I think the reality is that there is a bias against leaders who are women, and I think they made a calculation not to necessarily want to highlight Rachel Notley's womanhood. They also have over 50% of their candidates who are women, which in itself is a statement. Number three, they did do a number of things on gender equality over the last 4 years, so I think they don't necessarily think they have as much to prove. I think the childcare commitment is significant, and all the research in the Canadian context suggests that this type of program will augment women's participation in the workforce. I was a bit sad not to see more of a distinct commitment to ending violence against women. And at a higher level, I think the platform was well presented. By reading it, I knew what the NDP government wanted to do. I got a lot of information about their record. And although they have a number of commitments, it still seemed reasonable to me. The document was 41 pages long. Okay, so over to the United Conservative Party. They have 31% women running, and they are led by Jason Kenney. This platform was a bit more difficult to navigate. They outline a few interesting commitments, including ensuring consent is taught in sex education, $5 million to support survivors of sexual assault, and to fight human trafficking in Alberta. They also highlight expanding the Women Building Futures program with $10 million over 4 years to support women who wish to pursue opportunities in skilled trades. I'll circle back to a few of those commitments in a second, but the UCP platform unfortunately also had a number of commitments that would negatively impact both women and folks in vulnerable situations, including seriously considering reducing the minimum wage for youth and alcohol servers and rolling back the 15-hour minimum wage to $13 an hour for those under 17. There's also, and I quote, Bill 2, the Open for Business Act, which gives Albertan workers more freedom, restore their right to a secret ballot, and bring balance to Alberta's labor laws to get job creators investing in Alberta again. I'm always a little bit weary when I hear tinkering with Alberta labor laws to get job creators investing, because what that says to me is that supports for workers and protections for workers may be rolled back. And again, based on the minimum wage commitment, that I think is a reasonable thing to assume. However, they do say that they will keep new forms of leave adopted in the recent labor laws, including personal and family responsibility leave, long-term illness and injury leave, bereavement leave, and domestic violence leave. We do talk about domestic violence leave in episode 9, if you're interested in learning more about what that is. So what I found to be striking about this platform is that the only real mention of women is under a section titled A Focus on Current At-Risk Domestic Violence and Human Trafficking. This section almost exclusively talks about women, and I find it very troubling that the UCP seem to only consider women in the form of victims. I obviously think ending violence against women should be a top priority, but if I read this platform as a woman, I would only see myself in it as a victim. The overall platform was not nearly as easy to navigate as the NDP platform. This platform was 113 pages long, so it's the winner on length of the four that we look at today. It was presented very much as a grab bag, And it's unfortunate because this type of format is not super accessible to many voters. It was barely accessible to me, to be honest, and I do this for a living. I want to think that this platform is presented like this because the party wanted to have an answer for everything, but I do worry that misleading the voter might end up being the reality. And I don't say this just off of a gut feeling or because it's 113 pages long, but rather because they outline commitments like this one. And I quote, help Albertans pay their bills based on budget 2018 estimates at $50,000 in income. A single Albertan would save $286. A single Albertan with two children would save $450. And a single Albertan with three children or more would save $524. So this is in relation to if they were to basically scrap the Albertan carbon tax. Why I find this commitment to be so troubling is because, yes, if they do cut the Alberta carbon tax, then the federal carbon tax would just be implemented and thus the tax rebate, which would result in Albertans getting exactly this in tax back. So it's basically a commitment that Jason Kenney will fulfill if he cuts the carbon tax in Alberta, because the federal carbon tax will be created and then these rebates will automatically kick in. So I just think that it's commitments like this that are misleading that lead me to believe this platform may be inaccessible to many voters. Okay, so let's head back east now. I don't think you could find two provinces more different than Alberta and PEI, so I'm interested to see how their platforms stack up. In the same fashion as above, I'm going to start with the governing party. So the PEI Liberals have 26% women running for them, and they're led by Wade McLaughlin, the only openly gay premier in Canada. So here are a few notable commitments that highlight women. The creation of a job first incentive, which will provide training and salary support for employees in areas such as hospitality, early childhood, transportation, and resource sectors, and they gain valuable early job experience in these fields. This would include support for women in trades, ensuring equality of opportunity and participation. Secondly, a workers' acceleration program. And they quote that they would partner with community organizations that help transition youth at risk, women, and newcomers into the workplace and provide training, placements, and opportunities here. They also have a commitment of ensuring that survivors of sexual violence have access to the legal aid advice they need, and they would propose a program that will empower survivors to make informed decisions regarding their potential and actual interactions with the justice system. Some other commitments that they outline that would impact women include expanding primary care teams, a commitment of $100 million in capital and operating investment for mental health services, investment in new home care nurses, which I hope would also include wages for and increase wages for home care nurses. They also have a commitment on controlling housing and rental markets. So essentially they say that although the government cannot control the housing and rental market, it can take steps to address affordability and availability, and they will work with community partners to challenge the supply and affordability issues in the province. So this is kind of interesting because I think it's not widely known that PEI over the last few years has started to have a real crisis in housing, because so many of the affordable housing spots have actually been kind of converted into Airbnb rentals because of the high tourist market in PEI. So I thought that that was actually interesting to be included there. They also highlight a minimum wage increase of $14 by 2022. And two really interesting things they focus on are, one, naming Prince Edward Island as the best early learning and childcare program in Canada. And they also actually say that they want to become the most accessible post-secondary education in Canada. So two high-level commitments that basically outline their focus on education. On the childcare front, they say that they would continue to build on their past successes, including adding additional spaces, creating early learning centers, and reducing parent fees. On the post-secondary side, they propose that they will increase the George Coles bursary, which would make post-secondary more accessible. They do also have a highlight that they would engage with Mi'kmaq and Francophone communities in the development of specific programs and services that recognize their unique roles in island culture. Overall, this platform seems pretty balanced to me. The focus for women seems to be more on economic empowerment through supporting entrance into the workforce and supporting some female-dominated jobs, including nursing and early childhood education. The platform is also well presented in a way that highlights the government's accomplishments and also outlines what they plan to do next. It was pretty easy to follow and just about 40 pages. So finally, we're moving over to the PEI Green Party, which is led by Peter Bevan Baker, and they have 33% women running for their party. This platform makes almost no explicit references to women, but it does highlight some commitments that disproportionately impact women, including providing health professionals with the opportunity to work to their fullest scope of practice, including but not limited to pharmacists, midwives, and nurse practitioners. They also say they would introduce comprehensive midwifery services to provide preconception, prenatal, delivery, and postnatal care in several centers with provisions for home births where desired and appropriate. They talk about expanding birth control coverage and options in PEI PharmaCare formulary. They talk about increased wages for early childhood educators. They also say that they would review and begin implementation of recommendations made by the PEI Coalition for Women in Government's 2019 report, Whose Job Is It Anyways? The Life and Work of an MLA. Other things of note in their platform include aggressively pursuing negotiations with the federal government for financial support to implement a basic guaranteed income pilot. I think this is the first time we see a guaranteed basic income referenced in any of the four platforms, so this is interesting. They also suggest that they would set up a commission to deliver a basic income guarantee pilot program. They want to lobby for national pharmacare, and they want to support the development of collaborative community healthcare centers to ensure local access to primary healthcare. In addition, they talk about increasing social services so that housing and food and personal allowance are more reflective of what islanders need. They talk about building the foundation for a new relationship between Indigenous peoples and settlers. They commit to increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2024. And as mentioned above in the PEI Liberal platform, And interestingly enough, as I mentioned during the Liberal platform analysis, the Greens have a commitment that they would provide regulations on short-term rentals such as Airbnb to ensure the market is managed by implementing limits on the number of properties per owner, requiring commercial registration for non-owner occupied listings, and implementing an accommodation levy. They do include an entire section titled Priorities for the Acadian and Francophone Communities. And this section is the only section in their platform that is bilingual. Overall, this platform is interesting. It's definitely quite different from the other three we've talked about today. It was actually a little bit difficult to follow because it outlines first mandate commitments, 5-year vision, 10-year vision, and 25-year vision. I think it's an interesting approach to lay out a platform like that, and vision is important. But I think perhaps if they maybe laid it out instead of by both title section and yearly commitments, maybe they could pick one. This platform was also the shortest of the four at only 31 pages. Quite a difference from Mr. Kenny's 113 pages. Some overall takeaways from all four platforms I had. Interestingly, and this actually isn't really relating to the platform, but perhaps it feeds into what they look like. The only one of the four parties I talked about today that are running at least 50% women is the party led by a woman, Rachel Notley's NDP. The governing parties had platforms that were similar in their layout. They outlined their record and showed how they would propose to move forward. And the similarities between the platforms in each of the two provinces was unique. It goes back to what Joan mentioned about the time and space analysis being a key element to the creation of platforms. Okay, that's enough for on platforms from me today. I'm going to cut the current affairs section because we went a bit long today. But I will say, if you live in either PEI or Alberta, please go vote. And if you're interested in learning more about one of the parties that I didn't cover today, you can go over to their websites and find their platforms pretty easy. I'd also love to know if you found value from this episode and if we should do it again for following elections. As always, please subscribe to stay up to date. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FemLonk.